listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Ewan Lowe.
And I'm Robin Whittaker.
And we are in week 7, wasn't it, of Epiphany. And our readings for today are Psalm 37, verses 1 to 11, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 35 to 50, and Luke 6, verses 27 to 38, though I've just realised that's not the order we're discussing them in.
No, that's okay, though. We'll start with the psalm, hey?
Sounds good.
So Psalm 37, which you could just read all of, but it is a long psalm, so the lectionary's given sections. I feel like this psalm introduces some of the themes we're going to see in Luke.
Yes, about very much so.
Ethical behaviour, doing good, what wickedness and goodness looks like. Mm-hmm. What do you want to highlight, Ewan?
It was one of the readings that I felt spoke to my soul after 2 years of COVID. And I think we're all there, right? You know, it's a frequent theme in just about everything nowadays. But it was this idea of, you know, do not fret. Do not be envious. You know, trust in the Lord. Stay on the straight and narrow path, basically. Yep. But also this sense of, I guess, peace and patience that I find myself lacking a lot of.
Yes, in don't this we season. All? Yep.
You know, and particularly this question of, you know, the wicked. And look, everyone will have different ideas of who these so-called wicked are. That's your prerogative, and you get to the best thing about being you is you get to decide who's bad and who's good, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there is a lot of sleep in this season that can be lost about things like that. You know, whether it's about, I don't know, vaccines or anti-vaccines or whatever you want.
And getting angry at those who are different to us.
That's right. Yep. That's right. And there's a lot of fretting that's been going on. You know, I know that I was in a place where I, at one point, in one of our lockdowns, I was just checking case numbers every day.
Yes.
And it really helped me when I went, you know what, I'm not going to do that.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I felt like that just to be super political, but I suspect this would go down okay now. You know, when President Trump was president, I would obsessively read Trump news headlines. And then I got to a point of like, why am I doing this? It just makes me angry. So I was struck by verse 4, the take delight in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I tried to do during some of our worst moments of lockdown, not always perfectly, obviously, was to practice gratitude, to remember what there was to be thankful for. And for me, that is part of what it looks like to take delight in the Lord and remember the gifts of God, even in the midst of really trying times where it feels like some of those things have gone. The being still and waiting patiently. I mean, we feel like we're waiting patiently or impatiently, but...
Well, even that next line, you know, do not fret over those who prosper in their way. That's such an interesting, challenging line, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Because you look at other people and you go, oh, these, you know, terrible people are doing really well. Why?
I know. And some people, you know, the rich have got richer during this period and the poor have got poorer. Mm-hmm. And it's not to... Do not fret, I think, is not to say... Don't be concerned about justice, but rather that we put our energies into more productive things than fretting about.
That's right.
Yeah, or jealously fretting about those who seem to be doing well.
That's right. You know, there's fretting and then there's activism, I suppose.
Yes, yeah.
Would be one way to think about it. A couple of other things I noticed. This is more just for interest than anything else, but, you know, the way that we've cut, that the lectionary has cut this up, between verses 1 and verses 11, the text divides it up into sort of couplets, really. And it actually does form a little chiasm, which I really like, where verses 1 and 2 and verses 10 and 11 align, 3 and 4, 8 and 9, and then 5, 6 and 7 together.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of fun, but...
Nice bit of structure.
Yeah, good little... preaching tip from the charismatic preacher that where, you know, if you do that, if you have that symmetry or that structure, you know, it can help people to remember what you're doing as well.
Yeah, that's true. You can structure sermons around that and come back to where you began, kind of.
And that's why it's there, right, you know?
Yes, yeah, to help people remember. Mm. So, I mean, look, you could do a lot with this psalm and it obviously speaks, I think, into today's world quite profoundly, but could also be used obviously as prayers or reflection or some other part of the service.
Yeah.
I really like Oh, I mean, the lectionary takes us back right to, at the end to 39 to 40, but I actually like some of the verses that have been skipped out, like 27 and things, you know. Again, depart from evil, do good. We're going to see that very much in the Luke reading. Mm. The Lord loves justice. I mean, if you're going to really meditate on this, read all 40 verses, really. But again, it takes us back, a bit like Jeremiah did last week, to a reminder that God is the source of salvation and justice, and you know, that trust lies there.
It's a bit of a, you know, they take refuge in him because he rescues them, but he rescues them because they take refuge in him kind of situation, isn't it?
Yeah. Nice parallelism we get in Psalms.
That's right. And of course, used by this psalm mentioned or touched on very briefly in the Beatitudes, put into Jesus' mouth in Matthew.
Yes.
Where was it? I had it a moment ago. You know where it is.
Somewhere in there. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's the psalm for this week. Mm-hmm. So Luke, chapter 6, verses 27 to 38, continues on from last week's gospel reading.
And it doesn't get any easier.
No, more hard words from Jesus here.
Delightful.
Yes. And this is really, in a sense to me, this is, you know, we've gone from the kind of beatitudes and woes of the passage just prior to this to now like absolute imperative, very clear teaching. Do not do this, do this, you know. Starting with really the love your enemies, which is a fairly, I mean, I see the influence of Leviticus all through here, partly because I've been spending some time reading Leviticus, but Leviticus talks about love your neighbour, and then it extends to love the alien in your land in Leviticus 19. Mm-hmm. But this enemy love seems to be a fairly radical associated with the Jesus tradition, or at least later Judaism.
I mean, it seems inherently silly, right?
Yes.
Why would you love your enemies?
Like, exactly. The whole definition of an enemy is someone who does not have your best interest in heart, and then why would you love them? So, yep.
Ties in well with the psalm, actually.
It really does,
yeah.
Yes, it's a good pairing. I think we need to talk about what love is, because I think mostly in Western culture, at least, love is a feeling.
Yeah.
And this is not saying feel gushy towards your enemies.
No, please don't. That's really weird.
Most of us couldn't achieve that anyway. Mm. But, you know, as we go through this passage, we will see that love your enemies is all about action. Mm. So it's about doing good, blessing even when you're cursed, praying when you're abused, not returning violence for violence, so the striking. If someone strikes you on a cheek, turn the other cheek. I don't think that means lie down and stay in a situation of abuse. We need to be really careful with this stuff. Mm. But it is about not retaliation, violence for violence. Mm-hmm. Again, an echo of Leviticus here that's being updated in Jesus' teaching, which he does in other places too, of kind of almost going to the more challenging interpretation of Torah. Mm. And then, you know, give the shirt from your own back. So loving is all of those things.
It's practical actions that that bless others, really.
Yes.
Right, and there's that blessing woe thing again. I find it, one of the things that Richard Hayes, again, sorry to bring Richard Hayes back in again, but one of the things he mentions, you know, is that there's this, that this part of it, 27 to 38, it's almost the outworking from above, from the blessings and woes. And it's this idea that the blessings and woes aren't just there forever. That there is commensurate action that you know, results, either ends up resulting in blessing and woe, or these come out of that.
Yep.
So, you know, as you say, there is a very clear imperative. Yeah, you've got to go do this stuff.
Yep.
It's not great. You know, it's hard to do, so have fun with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you want to talk a little bit about the parallelisms with Matthew as well?
Oh, you can talk about that? What do you have in mind?
I guess I just wanted to, you know, just highlight to and remind everyone that, you know, Matthew does have, you know,
similar
things.
Yeah.
And the context is different.
Yes. Yep. In Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. And, I mean, again, if you're going to do a close read of this, comparing what Luke updates or changes or omits from Matthew can be helpful to see Luke's emphasis here.
I think Luke is harder.
I think Luke is harder.
Substantially harder, quite frankly.
Yep. And as we saw in the Beatitudes, more practical, like it is grounded ethical action that has to do with poverty and wealth. And we're going to see lending and money he has in mind. So,
yes.
You know, again, enormously practical behavior here. This is not some lofty or figurative or spiritual kind of.
No. Yeah. It's very grounded directive teaching, isn't it?
And we, in verse 32, I'm just looking at here, if you know, if you love those who love you, what credit is it to you? Even sinners love those who love them. I mean, sinners is Jesus in Luke's way of just referring to those people outside the faith. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is a sinner. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we're not sinners too, but that's just a way of saying those other people. Mm-hmm. those other people do that too. And we know in early Christianity, Christians became known for, you know, in the second and third century, for their kind of radical, practical love for each other, for the way they cared for the widows, they cared for those who were, they shared food, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we see that very clearly in Luke, that that was something that distinguished this ethical mandate. And, you know, the lending stuff, what do we know about lending? And the credit.
Well, I mean, it's not great.
Yeah.
well, it depends, right? Because there's an element to which you do have severely predatory lending practices.
Yes.
And sometimes that kind of forms around, what's the right way to put it? Ethnic lines?
Yes.
You know, in that time. Or you know, cultural lines, perhaps, might be another way of saying it. But it's sort of like, yeah, we look after our people.
Yep.
But we were happy to rip off other people.
Yes.
Not our people.
Yeah.
And you will still find that in many cultures today to an extent.
Yes, yeah. We have a different set of ethics for our people versus those people. Mm. And again, this love of enemy is breaking down those kind of divides. I mean, and he returns here to this, you know, don't judge, forgive, you'll be forgiven. I do want to just say we need to be careful how we talk about this stuff. I read this and I had in mind a woman who came to me when I was years ago in my first parish who'd been abused by this man, and she said, I need to know how to forgive him. Mm. And so we had a whole conversation about what forgiveness meant because she, you know, was rightly so seeking to do the right thing and say, how can I expect to be forgiven if I don't forgive? Mm. But her idea of forgiving was forgetting and allowing someone to continue in. And so we talked about that forgiving is not about allowing abuse to continue or, staying in abusive situations. So, again, we just need to be a bit careful that we don't talk about this so glibly it can send that kind of message.
Yeah.
And even the turning of the other cheek is about, it's about, you know, not retaliating and, yes, still trying to do the best for someone, but doing the best for someone who's abusive or violent might be actually keeping apart from them and the consequences of those actions.
Well, that's right. You're not blind, right?
Yes.
Forgiveness isn't blind, nor should it be.
Yeah.
And forgiveness is perhaps helping people not to make the same mistake again.
Yeah, and not allowing them to stay. Yeah, yeah. Mm.
That kind of stuff. Yeah, very important to bring that up and to point that out.
Because
these verses can be used as a weapon, unfortunately.
They can. Yeah, and they have been used to tell women to stay in bad situations and probably men too, but yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the virtue ethics stuff as well?
Yes.
I mean, let's pull back from that language a little bit, but there is that idea, again, you know, not just in Jewish but also in Greco-Roman culture, thinking of the time, that, there's this idea of reciprocity.
Yes.
Right? You do me a favor, I'll do you a favor. What that sort of is expressed through is the patron-client relationship, as some of you might be aware. So, you know, the richer you are, the better well-off you are, and people come to you, they ask you for money or, you know, help me be my lawyer, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
These types of things. And then after that, I am in your debt.
Yes.
And I will do you favors and I will represent your house well and, you know, vote for you and do all of these different things.
Yeah, yep.
So this idea of transactional reciprocity, I think, is something that Luke certainly is playing with and then saying, well, what's the point of that?
Yes. Yeah, and is challenging, right? I mean, he's challenging that you would only do good to those who can help you out or who can return the favour in that very, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just interesting that it is a very universal, you know, multicultural saying here. I mean, I guess it's not that surprising given humans are humans, but yeah,
yeah.
It is a direct challenge to cultural practices of the time,
yep.
which I think sometimes we forget. We forget that Jesus is very, and you know, most of the biblical texts do directly challenge particular aspects or ideas of culture.
Yes.
That, you know, are held to be wrong. Like, you know, in a previous episode, you mentioned this idea of idolatry all the time, and that takes different shapes all the time.
Yeah.
But there's always this idea that, no, we can be better than this.
Yeah. And I mean, I always find that getting that balance right is tough with Jesus because at times he is so just characteristically Jewish, and I don't want to remove that. You know, he is representing a strand of Judaism and is deeply entrenched in that. Mm-hmm. And yet also countercultural and critical of cultural practices, both within Judaism and within the wider culture.
Yeah.
And, of course, people here are living in a, you know, we want to kind of put people in categories today and back then, you know, it's Jew or Gentile. It's, you know, but these are Jews living in an occupied territory.
That's right.
They're already living in hybrid spaces and navigating cultural difference all the time.
Yeah, I mean, us immigrants.
yep.
You've got to learn to negotiate between your existing cultural practices that you've come from, and the ones that you're stepping into, and sometimes Jesus just cuts through all of them and is like, no, they're all bad.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, forget it. Just do something different. And that I find consistently to me is the challenge of Christian faith or Christian identity is. What is a Christian identity in the midst of competing cultural realities?
Yeah.
Very, very challenging. But sometimes it's really clear, like we find in Luke here.
Yeah, that's right. And it cuts
good to everyone.
Yes, it does. That just reminded me of, I mean, that could be a really good preaching theme to unpack it along those cultural terms you were just saying, you know, in terms of what we as communities, and it'll be different in every place, and we've got listeners from around the world, what our cultural values are about what doing good looks like, about what being a Christian looks like, right? I mean, being a Christian in some parts of the world looks very different in terms of how you signify that. It might be voting a certain way or not voting a certain way. So to have conversations with your communities about what doing good looks like and maybe where that needs to be challenged, that you think you're doing good, but actually let's return to what Jesus is talking about here in terms of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a film with my wife and one of the things, it was a Chinese film, and one of the things one of the characters said to the other was, oh, family don't say thank you, because there is that assumption that if you're family, you will help each other out.
Mm.
So there's an interesting little thing already, right, where, you know, that plays into this idea that, oh, you're naturally going to help your family out.
Well, yes.
Good. But guess what? There's more than that.
Yep.
And I actually picked up in verses 35 and 36, there is that adoption language, or not adoption language, but familial language, right?
Yes.
Where you are children of God Most High, or you become children of God Most High. And that father language. And so, you know, it's like Jesus gets you coming and going, right? Where it's like, well, love your enemies. Oh, and by the way, you're all children, so you've got to be good to each other.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, I mean, that's the family stuff is the other way this is cutting through cultural stuff, where we know kinship. Mm-hmm. So as well as the client-patron kind of reciprocal relationships you talked about, you know, the expectation, and it's where Leviticus starts with the love your neighbour as yourself. In that original context, it's probably talking about fellow Jews.
Yeah.
Like you look after your own, right? So this is being expanded so radically that cuts across the familial lines in the same way that Jesus talks, you know, in other places in the Gospels about who are my brother and sisters? Well, they're people who hear my word.
Mm. And Paul picks up on the same thing, right? And he goes, well, you know, you're all adopted.
Yes.
You're all one big family, new family now. So, you know, kind of get your head around that.
Yes, exactly. And on that point too, with the children and this relationship with God, I mean, the ethics, there is again a reciprocity with the divine in that our ethical behaviour, or the ethical behaviour demanded here, is because this is the nature of God, right? Mm. So it's not, you know, the theology is we try and behave in the way God has behaved, which is to be far more merciful and crossing of boundaries than we are, I think.
Well, I mean, it says that, you know, be merciful just as your father is merciful, not
exactly
as your father forgives or is merciful to you.
Yes.
So that there's almost that removal of the it's about you sense.
And mercy in the Hebrew Bible is, you know, one of the dominant ways that God's love is expressed. It's often framed as love is showing mercy and compassion.
That's another interesting little cultural thing as well, you know.
Yeah.
Love looks different in different cultures.
Yes, it does. Yeah. So a lot to unpack there. We probably need to move on to Paul.
Yes.
I think we've thrashed through Luke, but so many things you could unpack there, as you can tell.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion?
So back in 1 Corinthians 15 for the last week, 35, well, the lectionary says 35 to 38 and then 42 to 50. If you're going to preach, you probably just want to read the whole chunk. But
you may as well.
Yeah. So more bodily resurrection stuff here. And again, we start the section with the question, how are the dead raised? Someone, this mysterious someone Paul keeps citing.
This fictive construct. Yes.
And with what kind of body they come. I'm personally far more interested in the second of those questions. But but Paul's response to both of them is full. Practicing his best pastoral sensitivity.
Yeah, please make sure you yell that when you read it.
Yes.
You know, I feel it full. Has to be emphatic.
Yes. Paul doesn't shy away from saying what he thinks very graphically at times, and this is one of them. And we get a kind of a image here that, of course, we know from some of Jesus' parables of the seed that falls into the ground and, you know, so playing on what happens to seeds and growth. And I don't know if you've got anything to particularly add to that image.
It's fairly self-explanatory. Yeah. I think it is stuff that people would have been very familiar with. Obviously, one of the big questions when you live in agrarian societies is subsistence and where is my next meal coming from?
Yeah.
And you know, we know that the Romans, one of the reasons they were able to be so stable was because they were able to secure supplies or food
right? chains. And,
and when they didn't, it often went pretty poorly for them.
Yep.
So it is important language.
Yes.
And many people would have been farmers.
Yeah, yeah. So very familiar in a cultural way. Paul plays with all these parallels here, so we need to be attentive to the heavenly bodies, earthly bodies, perishable bodies, imperishable, the man of dust he'll go on and talk about with Adam and the man of heaven who's Jesus, the first and the last. So we're getting these strong sort of images to draw some parallels. One thing I noticed that I think is really important when we think of heavenly bodies or resurrected bodies, and I'm drawing here on the work of Candida Moss, who wrote a book came out in 2019 called Divine Bodies. But I notice what's not here is language of perfection. So we need to be careful that heavenly bodies or resurrected bodies are not perfect bodies. Paul doesn't use that language, but I think I certainly know when I was younger, that was my idea, was like when I got to heaven, I was going to get the perfect body, which, of course, in my Western culture, I imagined to have long, skinny legs and blonde hair, which is not really me. But, you know, it's again to say how it matters, because how we imagine the perfect body is also deeply culturally entrenched.
Yes.
And then has implications for how we talk about bodies and whose bodies we value.
Well, that's right. Like every time I, you know, go and visit my family in different countries, they'll say, oh, you know, you're so skinny, you need to eat more. Or, oh, you're so fat, you need to eat less, right? So yeah, different conceptions of beauty and perfection.
Yeah. Yes.
Very, very important to people. There was something I was going to say as well about the importance of spirit amongst all this.
Oh, yes.
It's
important to have a Pentecostal bring
that's
us
right.
back to
yeah,
the
yeah,
spirit.
The Pentecostal charismatic will pick up on that. But
yeah.
To me, you know, he kind of almost makes these very strong contrasts between this and that, this and that, this and that.
Mm-hmm.
But the theme that runs through all of them is this question of spirit.
Mm.
And you know, having grown up in a Pentecostal charismatic tradition and still within that, obviously that is very important to us.
Yeah.
But there is also, I think, a tendency for us to downplay that, depending on what tradition you come from or where you sit and all that. we tend to forget that we are spiritual beings sometimes.
Yes, we can. Yep.
And
yes.
And, you know, sort of we almost sometimes, I wonder if we sometimes tone our language down a little to avoid scaring off or looking too new agey or whatever, where it's like,
yeah,
oh yes, I sat under the tree and, you know,
contemplated,
yeah, right,
something,
yeah,
yes,
that's right, you know, it's not a I meditated on the in the spirit on the word or something.
Yes, yeah,
there is a shift in language that I think we just, yeah, it's just worth noting that Paul is pretty unapologetic about this stuff.
Yeah, and again, I think we can see there Paul's Jewishness, where the whole identity of a human is it is this spirit breathed, created by God with dust and spirit. So it's never one or the other. It always has to be a both and. And in fact, they affect one another, right? Which is why, in the ancient world at this time, so much illness was framed as having an unclean spirit, because there was a sense that your spiritual state, I mean, we might want to clarify some of that language differently today, but it affected your health and your physicality.
I mean, there's still a bit of that and, you know, quite rightfully floating around today.
Yes, that's right, that greater connection about. So I just want to draw out some further things Candida Moss says, because she talks about, like, when we think about Paul here is talking about bodily resurrection and the kind of bodies we'll have as imperishable. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, one of the things we need to be conscious of as we think about, you know, heavenly bodies is do our identity markers carry over? So our
that's a good one.
Yeah, our gender, our ethnicity, our disability, our, you know, physicality. And she points out that when Jesus appears in his resurrected body, he has scars, right? So he has and there's some beautiful stuff she talks about. There is the so-called imperfections, in his case wounds from his death, are transformed, but they're not eradicated. So there's something about the heavenly imperishable body that is still us. It still bears, you know, our experience as humans, but it is transformed in such a way that's not the source of pain anymore. Or
I would even go one step further and say that in Jesus' instance, they're a source of liberation for others.
Yes.
Right? Because he invites Thomas, hey, check it out.
Touch it.
Touch it. You know, it's all good, you know. And it's such a strong apologetic for divine bodies and not eradicating, you know, your human existence and experiences.
Yep. So, you know, if you do want to talk about resurrection and resurrected bodies, there's all that stuff to think about, and it could be a way to explore almost again the more pastoral concern, which is what are our attitudes towards our bodies now and towards one another's bodies, and how can we honour the fact that God has made us embodied, but not to sort of idolise them in ways that reinforce really problematic cultural ideals of beauty. Anyway, that's one potential theme.
And one thing you might hone in on there is verse 38 as well. It's almost a little throwaway line, but it's God gives it a body as he has chosen.
Yes.
You know, and to each kind of seed, its own body.
Yeah.
And it's that whole thing, you know, when we live in a society that is very image conscious and there is a bit of, you know, there can be a bit of body dysphoria going around. It's going, hey, guess what? God chose this for you.
Yep.
You know, and that may be frustrating sometimes and you know, it may cause anger and you may have all kinds of emotions around that, but there is that sense of that spark of the divine within you.
That's right. Uniqueness, we're probably running out of time here, but the where Paul ends up, and this is my frustration with the lectionary, is it cuts short of where he ends up in 55 and 56, which is the where, O death, is your sting, right?
Yes, yes.
So all of this is geared, I think last week you talked about, you know, the pastoral imperative here. I feel like, again, we're returning to that at the end, which is where, O death, is your sting.
Yeah.
And for Paul, the sting is sin and sin that condemns us. And the whole point of belief in Jesus' resurrection is that God has defeated even death. The sting of death is gone, and that is deeply pastoral. I mean, it doesn't take away all the pain of death for those who grieve, but that there is hope beyond it.
Yeah, well, that's right. And important, I guess, because people die.
we all will.
It's a fact of life, and I think, as I said last week, I think there is a a pastoral element here of uncertainty that comes with death. Yep. We all know that. And Paul perhaps is trying to address that at the same time as he's trying to address some other things.
Yeah. So we have theology and pastoral concern all enmeshed here.
Which, of course, all of you listeners will be able to do as good preachers, yes, right?
That's right. Be like Paul. Or preach on the gospel.
Yeah.
But all the best with it.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.